morning, members. I'd like to bring the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Committee to order. Today, we're going to do some Bowser bills. We're going to do a House File 1596, Representative Parkinson. We're going to hear it for possible inclusion later on. You know what? We probably want to move. Do we want to get this amendment in? Yeah. Why don't Representative Parkinson? I think you'd want to actually move your bill so we can get it in the shape you'd like.
Thank you, Mr.
Go from there. Representative Parkinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1596 for possible inclusion, and then I would also like to move the A1 or DE1 amendment to the bill.
Members, discussion to the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. And amendments passed. Representative Torkelson, the bill's now in the shape you'd like to discuss. And for the audience, we will not be taking action on this bill today. It will be laid over for possible inclusion. So we'd like you to pay attention. As folks have noticed, there's a number of different bills that we've done that on. And we would like folks, if they have input and thoughts, be sure you're weighing in because things are going to go fast coming forward. Members, we are going to have to move some of these bills because there are some bills that are going to have to go to some other committees. So after we get some things straightened out, maybe by tomorrow we'll have a better feel for a roadmap. Representative Hansen has asked about bonding in the past, and I'm hopeful that we'll get going on those bills soon, too. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1596 deals with water planning. There's been an effort throughout the water part of government in the state of Minnesota to move towards a watershed-based approach to planning. Right now, our water plans are based mostly on county borders, and the value of those water plans is somewhat limited by the fact that they don't really reflect the move towards watershed-based planning. This bill is a permissive bill. It doesn't require watershed-based planning, but it does open a door for those counties or other LTUs that are interested in watershed-based approach to planning. I am not going to go through the details, but I sure would appreciate your consideration.
Mr. Bowen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ray Bowen. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts. As well, I'm speaking for the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. Over the last 2.5 years, we have been working together with leadership from these organizations, looking for ways that we can create more efficiencies and effectiveness in a number of areas, but the one we really scoped in on was watershed management and the planning arena. Several years ago, to kick off our local government roundtable efforts, we actually called together all the county commissioners, the SWCD supervisors, and the watershed district managers in St. Cloud. And we had close to 400 people show up. And we had a day-long discussion about things that we could do as local officials to create more efficiencies and effectiveness in what we do in state government. And the item that came out number one was the whole issue of the multitude of plans, water management plans, that have to be done, and the in many cases duplicity of plans. So that's the one we keyed on, and we've been working on in an effort to come up with some ideas, a way to streamline that and make it more efficient and effective. And then, considering the move that we are the fact that we are moving to a watershed-based process, our state agencies are moving that way. The legislature has spoken on that. So we thought this was an opportune time to move forward in that effort. And we had representatives from our various constituencies getting together to talk about this across constituency lines, and we think we've come up with a very good reform package here. We think we know it's going to reduce cost, because we are in fact reducing the number of plans from over 200 to less than 100. We think it's going to foster and encourage more working together with these groups, because if they have to sit down and plan out their watershed activities, their priorities, those sorts of things, then we believe, in fact, it's happening today in many cases, that it's going to force people to encourage people to work together on a watershed basis. And we know that's going to save money, and it's going to make the operations much more successful. So with that in mind, I guess what we, I'd like to clarify something. This is not a Bowser bill. This actually is a local government bill. We have worked with Bowser in facilitating this. They have helped facilitate us to get to this process. But this is very much a bill that was created and worked on and developed by three local governments that I'm representing here today. So with that, I guess what I'd like to do is ask John Jaski, the Director of Bowser, to step forward and talk about the, actually walk through the bill and talk about the technical aspects of it.
Thank you, Mr. Bowen. Welcome, Director Jaski, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. John Jaski, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. As Representative Torkelson and Ray both mentioned, this bill is, you know, aimed at a couple of main things. One is fewer plans. We want to see more effort that's currently going on into planning into actually putting results on the ground, and this is a major step in that direction. The other part is the integration or the stitching together of these plans on a watershed basis. That's something, as Representative Torkelson said, is something the state is moving towards from the scientific perspective, but we also need to do that in terms of managing and implementing the results of that science and telling us, you know, what to do where, and on a watershed basis, it's going to be a lot more effective for the long haul than remaining with the existing county boundaries, which drive most of the plans currently in place. These plans are prepared by soil and water conservation districts, counties, watershed districts, and we also have the water quality plans that are known as these TMDL implementation plans. And in essence, what we're doing is allowing all of those to become one on a watershed basis. So we'll walk through the bill. Before I get to that part that I just mentioned, which is the focus of legislation, there's a couple of housekeeping things in the front end of the bill that I'll mention first, and they have to do with a couple of things that Bowser has sought to get cleaned up in the legislation that describes the agency board and the operation of the board. On line 1.1, the voting members of the board appointed by the governor, and we had the addition of townships and cities a couple of years ago. Those are reflected in lines 1.11 and 1.12. One clarification that we are seeking is on line 1.10, which includes the appointment of the three citizen members of the board. One little thing that's come up is if some people have read this to say that if you served on a local library board or a park commission or something, that would prohibit you from serving as a citizen member on the Bowser board. And I don't think anyone ever intended that. So what this does is simply say that you are not allowed to be a state official and serve on as a citizen member on the board, but you could be a local official on a park board or a library commission or something like that. So we believe that that's the way the law was intended to read, and so this clarifies that. On line 1.21 and 1.22, we have this distribution of membership across the state to try and achieve a geographic balance to represent all parts of the state and all the issues that deal with water and soil conservation in those areas. One of the remnant pieces of legislation that's still in here on line 1.21 and 1.22 reflects the distribution among the soil and water conservation associations' administrative regions. The problem with that is, of course, that they can change those administrative regions as a nonprofit, non-government unit anytime they wish to, and that could cause some troubles with the status of existing board members. That has not happened, mind you, but it's trying to be preventative in making sure that we have stability on those board members who are appointed to four-year terms. Otherwise, it won't change anything. We believe that it will still achieve the geographic distribution that's warranted. You can see that's covered to some extent on line 1.20 with the requirement that four, but not more than six, come from the metro area, and on line 1.19 when it describes the distribution across the state of Minnesota. So that's a correction, just trying to clean up the statute language from years gone by. I will stop if you have any questions. I'm trying to answer any questions you might have. Line 2.7, this is just, you know, stating what's already the case. The board holds hearings and makes decisions, and the form of the result of that is an order that the board issues rendering their decision, and so we're just incorporating that in here because holding a hearing and making a decision takes some form to execute it, and the order is the means that we've been using to execute those decisions. On line 2.11 and 2.12, an addition here stating that the board shall adopt bylaws to deal with any potential conflicts of interest. That's something that we already have voluntarily adopted, but we think it's useful to have it in statute to perpetuate that for the long term. And then on line 2.17 and 2.20, and I guess and beyond that, the committee, one of the committees of the board is established in statute, this Committee for Dispute Resolution. They hold hearings on matters that have been appealed to the agency. One of the things that, again, because of the addition of the townships and cities a couple of years ago, this statute here prohibited those new members being a part of this particular committee. And it wasn't intentional, it just is a remnant, I think, from the decision that was made a couple of years ago to add those two members. And so we're proposing here that we use the current procedures in place to appoint members to the committee, and that committee adopt bylaws so that we have a clear understanding of the membership and duties of the committee. And I think that would be a more effective way to establish a membership and carry out the board's business on this one particular endeavor of dispute resolution. So I will pause there if there's any questions about any of those administrative items related to the board's operations.
I don't see any questions. Continue, Director.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll continue then. Now we're getting into the part that we talked about earlier in terms of the goals and intent of the legislation. These plans, as I described, are state-approved and locally adopted, and that's what carries the actions forward that follow from their adoption, including the authority to generate local revenue, the authority to, in some cases, do local land use decisions and controls through their ordinances and other official controls. The first sentence in this provision allows for these plans to, first of all, substitute for one another. So where you have a watershed district plan that would be something that the county would be able to support, they could simply adopt that as their plan. So we wouldn't have to make a new plan. We can have these plans serve as substitutes for one another. And this is going to be important, especially during this transition phase. It's going to take, I'm predicting, somewhere between 3 to 10 years to get fully through this, because these plans are 10-year plans, first of all. So some of them have just been adopted, and maybe some will have an adoption of a renewed plan before the 10 years has come up. But we also have the water quality work going on across the state that's on a 10-year cycle for assessment, monitoring, and reporting. And so we want to make sure we have that about 10-year time frame to work through this and into this watershed planning approach, and have it fully, we believe, they'll be fully ready for, you know, a new way forward in 10 years. But meanwhile, we're going to work through this transition of approximately 3 to 10 years. So in that interim, we need to have these plans, you know, stitched together to, on a watershed basis. And we believe that substitution is one viable way to do that without having to require a new planning effort. However, it also does provide the option for a new plan, a comprehensive watershed management plan. You'll see later on in the bill, there's a definition that's created to, you know, describe what that is. The one key word in there is that it's comprehensive. It deals with water quality, it deals with flooding, it deals with habitat, all the things that are currently required as part of these local plans, you know, currently. The expectation for what will be in that plan is pretty much the same. It's all of those things, but the expectation for precision that's in those plans will be elevated because of the more information that we have now, in particular with the water quality work that's been going on in the state for, you know, at least half a decade. The next sentence in this section on 2.28 talks about the ability to incorporate, in the case of the metropolitan area, we've got these local groundwater plans that may have some connection to surface water, and that's, you know, important if we want to build the connection between those two elements of the landscape. This next provision on 2.30 requires the board to put forth a watershed approach in all of its deliberations and decision-making related to plan approvals. And then finally, at the very top of page 3, and this is pretty important because watershed boundaries are natural, but they're also judgmental about where you draw an arbitrary line. You know, there's a area that drains the Mississippi River, but in some cases it's been subdivided by the location of gauging stations over time. In your handout, there's a map that shows the we call it the 8-digit hydrologic unit code watersheds. This is a long-established, you know, scale for using a watershed approach. I should point out that the basins on here, you can see those basins are also delineated, the Mississippi, the Red River, the Great Lakes, et cetera, the Minnesota River. That scale has been discussed before in terms of how we manage our water systems, but it's such a large scale that it really hasn't been viable in terms of action-oriented planning. And so the local government associations and other interested parties got together and thought that the watershed scale, this 81 major watershed, is about the right scale to do action plan work, and you know, putting together resources, joining forces on you know, projects and programs. I think that's the scale they believe is the most viable, and we concur with that. It's also the scale, by the way, that the PCA is using for their watershed assessment, so that's also a very important factor. So this provision at the top of page 3 would have Bowser prescribe a suggested framework so that the local governments, the counties, and the zone water districts and the watershed districts would have some sense of what the scale should be for a plan that would be developed and then ultimately approved and adopted. You can see there are some little pieces of watersheds, you know, that happen to be on a state boundary or some such thing that aren't going to necessarily be a full watershed planning area. You look at the very southeastern part of the state, look at watersheds 46 and 47, right? They're just barely parts of Minnesota. They're part of much more part of Iowa. We're going to need to find some ways to combine some of those just on a practicality standpoint. So we would be spending some time with the local governments and other agencies putting together a framework that we would suggest be followed. That's very similar to the approach that was taken back in the mid-1980s when the legislature passed a law in the metropolitan Seven County area to do watershed plans and implementation. So we believe that approach can work, provide some structure, but also provide some flexibility. And if there's a dispute about that, there's a process later on we'll describe that can reconcile that. On line 3.3, this describes the process that we would embark on to bring those stakeholders together to figure out how this framework, among other things, would unfold, what the criteria would be for plan approval and so forth. There's a lot of details that will need to be developed, and we want to use that stakeholder group to help shape those. On line, I guess, line 3.5, similar to what we've been doing with the drainage issues in Minnesota, the drainage work group was formed, and it's used the same approach of bringing a whole group of stakeholders together, working towards consensus, and then ultimately towards legislative action if warranted, or other actions that people have come to understand and support. And then line 3.7 is where the local governments, through their plans, would bring in the TMDL implementation plans that are part of the Clean Water Legacy Act in Chapter 114D. Most of you probably recall that the process for water quality assessments results in some cases where we have impairments, a total maximum daily load allocation, which means certain activities have to take place to clean up the water in that area where it's impaired. That's required by federal law and in state law as well. One thing that's in state law now, not in federal law, is there is a TMDL implementation plan, which is in essence the same thing that we're talking about here, is a plan to improve the landscape, improve the waters, and we believe that it makes sense, and so does PCA, to incorporate as much of that as possible into these local action plans, because they're going to be the ones responsible for the activities, both, you know, monetarily, from a regulatory point of view, but from an education endeavor to improve the water. So they support this language. Local governments believe it makes sense to incorporate that into their planning work. And so that's what this provision on 3.7 to 3.9 provides for. I'll keep going. On line 3.12, this is where we have this process for you know, review and at some point approval, or if a dispute arises, a way to adjudicate that. You can imagine that at some point there might be some question about the framework that's established for the watershed boundary for a planning effort. We don't believe there'll be a lot of those, but we need to have a process to deal with it if in fact there is a dispute about that. And so the way this would be set up, the local government authorities in a watershed area would propose to the agency, here's our boundary, and we're going to embark on our watershed plan for that area. they would probably want to ask for a boundary determination if there was some dispute about that. If they have total agreement, they can just go ahead and do the plan because they know what the boundary is going to be, and the state can then work with them on the conditions for getting that plan in shape for approval. If there were a question about where that boundary was going to be on a watershed scale, then we would want to resolve it before we embark on the plan, because otherwise you get a plan that doesn't have a defined boundary. So we need a process to ultimately define that boundary if there is some dispute about that. So the way this would work is they could request a determination in advance of the plan being considered for approval of a boundary determination first. So we would know where the plan boundary was going to be. And that's, in essence, the same way it works now in the metropolitan area and has since in the mid-1980s. They get to choose the boundary, but if there's a dispute about it, we'd have to reconcile that. The way that's reconciled then is, you know, with information is received and the hearing is held. And if they don't believe that that decision is correct, they can go to the Court of Appeals, like other matters that come to our agency would go. You can just see that here described on 3.20 through 3.22. And then on line 3.22 to 3.24, there's a provision that would allow them to go through a dispute resolution or mediation process in lieu of going to court, or prior to going to court, if that's in fact what it takes. We believe that approach has been very successful in the past to avoid the costs and time considerations that a court proceeding might entail. And again, we don't believe there's going to be very many of these, but we have to have some process if in fact there is a boundary dispute that cannot be reconciled among those local governments who are going to be part of that watershed area. I will turn to page 4 at the top. This is a provision that's being removed here and inserted elsewhere to allow extensions of existing plans. Current language that's being removed here on top of page 4 is for language for county plans. We want to have some ability to extend existing plans of all forms if necessary, so that we can synchronize the plans on a watershed scale over that 3 to 10 year time frame that's coming ahead of us. On page 4, line 4.14 to 4.20, this is where the new term is created that we believe long-term we'll be all working towards, and that is working on a comprehensive watershed management plan that would substitute for all of the other plans that are currently in law. Again, you can read here what it says, but it's comprehensive. It covers, you know, water quality, flooding, groundwater to some extent, habitat if necessary. All of those things would be folded into this comprehensive watershed management plan. That's important because we don't have the luxury of managing water resources just for water quality or just for flooding or just for habitat. We've got to do all of those things together, and that's what this plan would prescribe the means to accomplish. And you can see down on page 4, line 4.22 to 4.24, this is where the reinstatement of that flexibility to extend plans would be provided, not just for county plans, but for watershed district plans and soil and watershed plans as well. bottom of page 4, line 4.28 through 4.33, we're just incorporating all of the various definitions of these plans. And I know it looks like we're adding more terms, but we're actually providing the ability to remove those terms over time once we get towards this comprehensive watershed plan over this 3 to 10 year transition period. On page 5, very similar at the top of page 5, that's doing the same thing, putting all these plans into equal status and then allowing for the substitution or for each other or for this comprehensive watershed plan to cover all of them. On line 5.16 to 5.25, this is some language that was put in place in 1986 when the county water planning statute was passed that prescribed a specific way for the county to generate their levy to match the state money that went to that local water management program. You know, since then, the counties have found other better ways to find that match source, and we believe, and they support this, that this language is no longer needed, and there's other ways that the county can generate their match. They still have to do the match to get the state money, but they have other ways that they can come up with that requirement. On the bottom of page 5, the beginning in line 5.25, This language is, again, all about the financial assistance in the state that goes to local governments to support their work on water management that supplements the work that they do locally in terms of the funds they also bring to the table from their local revenue sources. This provides a performance-based approach to those grant-making endeavors. And the grants would follow the plans as they currently do. We don't, under this provision or anywhere else in the bill, look to change any of the current grant-making structure. We don't look to change any of the authorities that local governments already have and are using. It simply allows for them to stitch those things together if they have already authorities and money on a watershed basis, and this language here provides for that. On page 6, again, this is more of the same, just making sure that the language is fully covering all the various plans that are out there and then allowing for the provision of a comprehensive watershed plan to replace all of them. And then on line 6.17 through 6.22, the performance-based grants that have been described back on page 5, this provides some direction to the board about what criteria shall be considered when we develop the performance-based criteria for the grant making. You can see there that it describes science-based assessments, organizational capacity, priority resource issues, community support, partnership potential, multiple benefits, and delivery of the program's efficiency and effectiveness. So those are some of the criteria that would be considered as the basis for funding from the state to those local plans. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will pause and take any questions or comments.
Representative Drzkowski, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Jaski. Two questions. The first one is on 1.10. Director, insert the limitation of state governmental office. I'm wondering about the wisdom in this statute originally. It seems that it was written this way to limit situations where, you know, the local planning and zoning officer would suddenly be on the board and the board would be overrun by local units of government folks, and there wouldn't be distinction between them. There wouldn't be grassroots representation on the board. I don't know. I'd be interested in your comments on that. I would prefer, actually, at least at this point, to not have that change. The other question is on 3.19 through 3.24. I'm wondering if it makes sense to actually have the dispute resolution process happened before the Board of Appeals. Maybe specifically suggest in the language that you try the dispute resolution thing first, and if that doesn't work, then you go to the Board of Appeals. That was just a suggestion or a thought there. Interested in your thoughts on that.
Thank you. Director?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drzkowski, your second point first, I would agree that, you know, that would be the way the process would unfold. Is it would make no sense to go to court first and then try and, you know, remediate or resolve a dispute through the mediation process. So we would, you know, obviously insert that process in front of any potential court proceeding. To your first point on page 1, I appreciate what you're saying. In fact, that is the goal of the citizen member, just to bring that true grassroots perspective. The question that's been raised is simply, if I'm a citizen, does that mean I have to give up every other thing that I've been part of at the local level to now serve as a citizen member on the board? So if I'm on the library board, you know, how does that affect me in any negative way in terms of being a citizen member on the volunteer board? It's just a legal question that's been asked, and, you know, I can appreciate what you're saying. I don't believe this would change that, because it would require that they're representing themselves as a citizen member on a state board, but I guess I can't guarantee you that there wouldn't be some other position they might hold that would affect their thinking. It's probably just not possible to write something that would be that precise. But we believe this would be helpful, because otherwise someone could be disqualified by serving on a local board that had nothing to do with the mission of the agency.
Representative Drzkowski, did you have a follow-up?
I do not, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair and Director Jaski.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drazkowski, I think I know a little bit of the history on this, and it was by, and maybe Mr. Bowen can correct me on, but I think it was former Representative Osmond that had this put in, and the concern was city staff or other local unit government staff that had a job during the day that was maybe working on issues and then would be also being appointed. So that was that's the background on this. It's probably about 8 to 10 years ago, and it was a specific concern that arose by having people that were city staff or people that were reviewing plans or that were doing the day-to-day work and then got appointed, and to not have them be in the policy side when they were doing the implementation side. So that's a little bit of the legislative background, and I think Mr. Bowen's shaking his head.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good Direct. Point, and maybe there's a way to, you know, aim it at that issue you described, which is a staff position that would be serving as a citizen member that would be associated with some of the agency's business. That was something that that was discussed, and that Representative Osmond did make a change. I don't know if it was in this provision of the bill. I think it was actually in the metropolitan section of statute in 103B. But we can go back and look at that, and maybe that'll help address the question that Representative Drazkowski raised and see if we can improve the language to deal with that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 2.24, it says the board may. On line 2.28, it says the board may. And on line 2.30, it says the board shall to the extent practical. Does this require them to really do anything?
Director.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Representative, the answer is yes. It says that, you know, there are places where we will need to adopt policies to make sure these plans are stitched together on a watershed basis. The reason the word may is used because in some cases it can't be done immediately that way. As I said, there's going to be this 3 to 10 year transition that we're going to have to go through to be able to. We can't change this overnight because they've got plans in place. We can't even, you know, digest the information that fast. So that's why we use the term may in the first two instances. And in the third instance, the word shall is there because the local government says, as well as we support the idea that we should be and shall be working towards this watershed approach long term. So it's more of an issue of timing than anything else the way it's written.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author or the testifiers, I'm looking on the section that begins 1.19 to 1.22. And the stricken language, I think, tries to provide through kind of a method of dealing with an association's administrative regions to have some regional balance. But what concerns me is line 1.20, and I didn't really support this when it went in, but if I can count up, besides the commissioners and the Extension Service, 15 public members, we are statutorily limiting the amount of Metro people where they could never even come close to parity in terms of representation. It says at least 4 members, but not more than 6 from the metropolitan area. Which I think the definition there is the 7-county metro, not the 11-county metro. But I think we just went through redistricting yesterday, folks, and there was a reapportionment based on population, which is how we establish our representation. And here we have representation that says, well, you can't even get close in terms of representation for the metropolitan area. You're going to limit it to 6 members. It's not land that votes. It's people that vote. And it's people that pay the taxes. So I would encourage or like your opinion on whether it's fair, particularly after we just went through reapportionment, to limit on a 15-member citizen board not even to have no more than 6 members from the metropolitan area.
Representative Hanson brings up an interesting point, but looking at the state map, this is set up by watershed, which is more geographically based. And by having people from, you know, you look at the major watersheds listed out here, I think it's important on this kind of, you know, proposal to sort of have a diverse representation by the different watershed areas, because not all have identical concerns. And so I think there might be, you know, a little bit of location and the fact that the metro is in one of 84 might be part of the leaning. But, Director, can you comment to Representative Hansen's question?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I guess I won't be able to comment on the equity of it. But we'll say that in the metropolitan area, there is a law that deals with watershed management and has since the mid-1980s, and so that process is not really being affected by this bill. And that process includes, as you know, watershed districts as well as water management organizations, which are, you know, handled by cities with elected officials, you know, in charge of that, and the counties appointing the watershed district members. So you have those local elected officials taking that responsibility. Clearly, when members serve on the Bowser Board, my experience has been that they are representing, you know, a statewide responsibility, and we haven't really, in my tenure there, seen a conflict over, you know, a particular geographic area of the state. So we're not proposing any change to the current legislation in that provision, so I guess I'll leave it to the committee to think about how you want to deal with that.
Are there any further questions?
Not to this, but on the bill.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bone, you suggested, or you said that there were folks that are already moving right now toward this kind of approach. Could you give us a specific example or two?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative McGinnis, I think one that I just heard about was in Pearl River. There was a meeting several weeks ago where people sat around the table from the counties, the watershed districts in those areas, and SWCD, and we're dealing with the issues around the Pearl River watershed as a whole. We have two watershed districts within the Pearl River that touch in the Pearl River, but there are also counties there. The SWCDs were present. They're all sitting around working very collaboratively together. And I think Director Jaski was at that meeting, and maybe he can relate more about exactly how they were working.
Director?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGinnis, yeah, there are a lot of examples of a watershed approach. And so I think it's not that whole idea is brand new, but we're trying to move it with a comprehensive way of managing water in Minnesota and to make it happen faster. The Crow River example, and I don't believe St. Paul often enough, but I did go out to this meeting and I saw what I thought was sort of the future in action there, where they don't have a comprehensive watershed plan, unfortunately, but they have already begun to meet regularly every month or every other month to figure out which projects are most important, how they're going to put their money together to do them, and how they're going to use the infrastructure that they all have as well as the state to measure the results and pick the most important undertakings. So that's sort of happening. They asked me, you know, could we have a watershed-based plan for all of us to operate under? And I said, interesting that you asked, because, you know, for 2.5 years now, they've been working on trying to build something towards a bill like this that would allow that to happen. In that case, you know, instead of having five county plans, you know, I don't know how many TMDL plans, and, you know, some water districts also having plans as well as two watershed districts, we could have one comprehensive plan that would be really well done once every 10 years, amended as needed, and then they would spend the interim working on the actual getting things done. They would have their attention, their resources, and their commitment bound together by that plan, and then annually, monthly, whatever it takes, they would be working to pursue improvement on the landscape under that plan umbrella. And the River Valley's got a couple of cases where watershed districts have adopted plans, and the county has adopted a watershed district plan already because, for example, in Traverse County, it's wholly within a watershed district. We've got joint powers of counties operating already in the Snake River, Redwood River, Cottonwood River, Zumbro River, you know, but they all still have to do separate plans under current law, so this would allow them to do a singular plan they all would get behind and support.
Thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things. Mr. Jasky and Representative Torkelson, that whoever wants to get in on this, but do you envision this as taking in invasive questions? We're talking about management, and we're going to spend a lot of money doing management for invasives, and it seems to me utilizing all the powers we can muster might be a benefit.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Bond,
Representative Purcell, yes, very much so. You know, watershed districts, especially up near you, are very much involved in that whole issue, and I see more of them getting more involved, and I think very much, yeah, and that's going to be a key issue over the next decade or two.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Purcell, I would just add that the term comprehensive was in there on purpose to make sure that we are managing our water systems with all those various aspects that are important in mind. They will have to decide, you know, exactly what approach is needed and what the science is telling them and how to find the money to pay for it in conjunction with the state, you know, and that's what these plans are about. And I should point out that, you know, the state agencies have been and always will be expected to be a part of the process of developing these plans. They are now. We want to bring that science and those resources into this equation in a more explicit way and in a way that's more efficient as well, because we can only do it, we do it once for the watershed. We don't have to repeat it for the county, repeat it for the soil and water, we can repeat it for a watershed district plan. So that's going to be a more efficient use of the state resources on that issue you raised, as well as many others. I should also point out that, you know, although this wasn't an agency bill, as Mr. Bowen said, because they led this and we facilitated the governor's office is supportive of this language. They believe this will help us be more efficient in the way we carry out our water management responsibilities, and believe that bringing the good science will add to the credibility and the effectiveness of these plans as well. So I want to put that on the record as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple more things here. I do have a question, and I didn't hear it or see it, regarding lake associations and how you wrap them in, and I assume that's something that you've considered, and I know there are some property associations in various watersheds that are very active and very protective of their water quality, etc. So just give me your feedback on that and how you fold that in.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Purcell, right now the lake associations are very involved in the planning process, and especially in not only in the watershed district world, but also the counties and SWCDs. So I would see no change in that. You know, we certainly encourage them to be involved in that planning process, and they are, and that's to our benefit. So we don't see that changing.
Yeah, you know, one of the
director,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Purcell, one of the things that will not change and probably will be added is that these local plans, there is a local proceeding, you know, hearings and outreach to gather input. Many of these organizations have a task force specifically set up to develop the plan and then monitor its implementation. That's above and beyond just the local government board or council that's going to be in place to approve the plan or adopt it. So we believe that'll be only same or better in terms of incorporating, you know, lake association or citizen input.
Representative Purcell.
Mr. Chair, just one and more of a comment than a question here now. But I see TMDL mentioned in here numerous times, and I think this is good. I sense that we're on a trajectory that might actually get us to doing what many of the lake associations up in my district are endeavoring to do, and that is be proscriptive about that and preventative management as opposed to waiting until we've got a restore and doing a restorative TMDL. So just a comment. I see this as a potential move in a positive direction there.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Purcell, these plans do deal with both restoration and protection, and looking for the most cost-effective solutions to either of those.
Are there any other questions from the committee members. Okay, I want to thank Director Jeske and Mr. Bond and Representative Torkelson for bringing this forward. And I've really enjoyed the discussion. It's been a good topic. And we will lay over House File 1596 for possible inclusion in a bill at a later time.
Thank you.
And we're going to move on to House File 2393, Representative McElpatrick. You could.
Moving on now to House File 2393, I will move that bill. Welcome, Representative McElpatrick.
Thank you.
And you have an amendment to make your bill complete?
Yes, I have. Author's amendment.
And that is the A1 amendment?
Yes, it is.
I will also move the A1 amendment to House File 2393. Any discussion on the amendment? If not, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Amendment is approved. Representative, to your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate your hearing my bill this morning. It is the result of a situation that occurred in Aiken County in my district that was brought to my attention. I became aware that the regulations regarding wetlands are so restrictive that it can be difficult for farmers to do even minor actions on their own property that are necessary in counties that have a very high percentage of wetlands. The counties with abundant wetland percentages are not usually farmed intensively, and I believe that we can afford some slight modifications in the regulations in these areas. There are two objectives to this bill. The first is to make the language more understandable. And the second is that in counties with abundant wetlands, that we allow farmers slightly more freedom in what they are permitted to do on their own property. We have a responsibility as a state to protect our wetlands, but as a state, we also have a responsibility to look after our small farmers. So with that, I feel that this bill allows us to do both. I have John Jaske, again, who will be able to answer questions on the more detailed aspects of the bill. Thank you.
Questions from members? John, would you care to walk, Mr. Jaske, would you care to walk through the bill for us, please?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I see that staff, Ms. Taylor, has prepared a summary that was available back here. Hopefully all of you have seen that, which I think does the good job of describing what's going on in the bill. Maybe I'll just walk through it section by section. The author's amendment did change Section 2, so that's the one that probably has the most discussion. So I'll cover the other sections first. Section 1, this change would, in essence, when a landowner who's operating on agricultural land affects a wetland, there's a set of standards that apply for replacement of those wetlands that in essence says the ratio is 1-to-1. However, there's landscapes that in some cases are being changed from agriculture to some other use, you know, either shortly after that alteration occurs or, you know, sometime down the road. The current law says that if you take advantage of that agricultural exemption, you have to keep it in ag use for 10 years so that people don't, you know, abuse the agricultural exemption. One of the things that's remaining in the law here that I think it would be useful to address through this section is to remove the requirement that a deed restriction be placed when that land is altered so that the future buyer of a land that had a wetland filled on it knows that the area had been altered because of agricultural use, not some other use. Now, that's necessary in certain cases, but a lot of cases, these impacts to agricultural wetlands are occurring quite distant from any place where you're going to see a conversion of that land to some other use. And so in those cases where there is an expected conversion, then the local government can require the deed restriction, but otherwise it would not be mandatory everywhere else. And it currently is, and it has some cost factors associated with local governments having to follow up and make sure the deed restriction is put in place. And then it also, you know, puts a question mark on the title, you know, if someone's going to change the land even just for agricultural purposes down the road. So we believe that this could work to make it a judgment call on the part of the local government as to when this deed restriction is needed, and that's what this language would do. And we would support that this would help be more efficient and practical, I guess, about that restriction. I'm going to jump to section three because these sections aren't necessarily related, so I think we can do that if you don't mind. So I'll go to page six of the bill on line 6.25. A little bit of context for the whole Wetland Conservation Act it maybe is in order here because we are looking at just a couple of little pieces of it. It is the state's primary wetland protection law. It's been in place since 1991. Over that 20 plus year period now, we've had lots of adjustments to it to align with federal standards, to address local issues, to address the differences in Minnesota that we see from one corner of the state to another in terms of the wetland resources. And so a lot of adjustments have been made over time. One of the most successful parts of this has been the approach of using a wetland banking program, which allows someone who wants to make a wetland by restoration or creation to have those acknowledged and then used as an offset or, against those who are going to need to fill a drain of wetland for a particular reason. This provision here would allow more of that to occur through various mechanisms that are currently in place with our wetland banking program, but also incorporate some of the new ideas that have been recently endorsed by the federal government under their wetland banking rule. That includes the ability to, you know, do a program where you would have fees paid to a system that would accomplish the replacement. Minnesota currently has something like that in place for some of our public road projects, but not all of them. It could, in some cases, work for the agricultural lands that were described by the author in terms of the problems she experienced in her district. This doesn't require this. It sets up the possibility of building a wetland banking program that is perhaps sector-specific. Again, we believe that this is an idea that will take a good bit more work on the part of both private and public sector interests to make it real, but it is something that is now endorsed by the federal government, and you see the Army Corps of Engineers and the USDA organizations named here. There's two of them that are specifically interested in seeing if we can use this provision in a greater way in Minnesota to both get better wetland replacement, but also more cost-effective options for landowners who can't avoid impacting a wetland. And then on page seven, under section four, under the Federal Clean Water Act, there is a provision under called section 404, which gives the federal government, originally through the EPA, but delegated to the Corps of Engineers, the authority to require, you know, permits for projects that impact wetlands and other waters of the state or of the country. And in this case, in Minnesota, the Corps of Engineers, St. Paul District, is the one that carries out this program in Minnesota under the Federal Clean Water Act. A lot of what they do is you know, also accomplished through the Wetland Conservation Act. And over the years, we've built mechanisms, general permits, letters of permission, and so forth to align the state program with the federal program so that the state program fulfills all the federal program requirements and you don't have to get a separate federal permit. Recently, one of the ideas that they've been working on in Washington or talking about is the idea of states assuming this program so that you wouldn't have to have a federal permit also. In two cases, in New Jersey and in Michigan, the states have done this 404 program assumption, and they've done it wholly. So the state takes on the responsibility, and the Corps of Engineers is no longer part of it, with the EPA providing that oversight that they currently do to the Corps of Engineers. One of the more recent ideas is a partial assumption of parts of that federal program, and that, if it were to become real, would be quite viable in Minnesota, in my opinion, for a couple of reasons. One is we have this wetland banking program that has been well-developed and acknowledged, and the federal government already utilizes it in many ways, but it also still requires redundant decision-making on a part of the Corps of Engineers. We also have, as I mentioned earlier, a process for dealing with public road projects that impact wetlands when they expand or widen or upgrade their roads for safety purposes. We've, by and large, gotten the Corps of Engineers to agree to that, but there are cases where they still have to do a duplicative decision-making step. And if we went through a partial assumption program, it could be that we would remove that extra step. So, again, this is setting up the possibility for the future. It doesn't change anything today. It would take some decision-making on the part of the federal government, either at the U.S. EPA or the Corps of Engineers or both, to make this work. But it would give us another avenue to pursue that simplification that we think is helpful without reducing any of the protection that is important for our wetlands. So that's the summary of Section 4. And now back to Section 2, which is one that was addressed through the author's amendment. This is one of the several exemptions in the law that have been there with modifications over the years since the beginning. And an exemption means that if you are qualifying for an exemption, you do not have to do any kind of replacement or mitigation for that impact. You can basically impact the wetland without any other provisions to follow. And so over the years, this exemption has been modified a number of times. And you can see in the exemption, it has these different amounts of wetland and type that can be filled without having to replace it. And it's distinguished by three different zones in the state of Minnesota. And I don't know if, Mr. Chairman, if the staff are able to get the map into your folders or not, but if there is a map in your folder that shows three zones of Minnesota, basically it's the northeast, the central, and the south and west, and it depicts the areas of the state where we have a portion of the wetlands that were originally here remaining. Okay, so we'll get you that map, but if you imagine Minnesota divided into three sections, the northeastern section basically from Pine County to Lake of the Woods County and Crow Wing County or so north and east, and then an area through the middle from all about Morrison County, Chisago County, that band, Benton County, and then everything else to the west and south, being the prairie pottle area of the state where we've lost most of our wetlands. That area is called the less than 50% area because it's lost more than half of its wetlands, in some cases quite a bit more. So we have these three zones, been in place a long time in this law. We have different levels of protection that are afforded the wetlands that are remaining there. So what this language would do is, really, I think the main point of this amendment is to separate this de minimis exemption into two categories. Areas where you're near or adjacent to a lake or river or shoreline area, and a section that would apply when you're not near a lake, river, or a shoreline area. That's the main shift that's being done with this amendment. I think that's helpful because it helps to clarify for people who would not need anyone else to determine their qualification for them if they're eligible for the exemption. So the first part of this in lines 1.5 through 1.19 in essence keeps the exemption pretty much as is, but it distinguishes this area outside of the shoreline wetland protection zone as is described on line 1.7. So that's, I think, helpful in terms of making the exemption easier to understand, because either you're in a shoreline weather protection zone or you aren't, and then you can determine how much applies. So if you're in, then lines 1.5 through 1.19 apply. If you're in a shoreline area, then you begin to apply the standards beginning on line 1.2. And this is where I think this, I'd like to have a little more time to work on this idea, because our staff were off on Monday with a holiday, and this bill came up pretty quickly. We didn't have a chance to go through all of the nuances of it, but it is a complicated part of the law, and I want to make sure we understand that as carefully as we need to make sure we're doing what we intend to do. But the way it reads now is you would have a 400 square foot amount you could fill, in most cases, sometimes drain, I suppose, most often fill, within that shoreline area. of these wetland types 1, 2, 6, or 7. And these types, just so you understand a little bit about it, is that the types 1, 2, 6, and 7 are the ones that do not typically have standing water. I'm breaking this down very simply. There's a lot more science to it than that, and we can show you pictures and things if that's important. And the types 3, 4, 5, and 8 are wetlands that have a good bit of standing water. Type 8s are the bogs, which of course are covered often by a vegetative layer above that surface water. So these are the categories of types of wetlands that can be impacted with a fill activity that do not require replacement. 400 square feet for the non-standing water wetlands and 100 square feet for those that do. Let me turn over on the amendment to line 2.1. Within the shoreland area, and for those of you who are familiar with shoreland zoning, there is a term called the building setback, where you have to keep your structures away from the shoreland. The shoreland zone is, you know, typically 300 feet on a river or 1,000 feet on a lake. But there's this area, very sensitive area often, between the building setback and the shoreline, where you want to make sure you have the most protection. And I think that one of the concerns that we have with this legislation as it's currently written is that provision on line 2.4 to 2.7 is being increased to 200 square feet in that very sensitive area. Now, you know, this exemption doesn't mean that you can and can't do anything there. It simply means that if you're going to do something there and you are given the authorization to, because it's not going to be an adverse impact or can't be avoided, you would have to do some mitigation to offset that. So we're concerned in particular about line 2.4 to 2.7, I guess, if you want to think about what we would like to spend some more time working with you on if this bill is held over. The remaining parts of this, line 2.8 through 2.18, are really to remove a separate or a layered category for the metropolitan area, which was put in law, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. It may not be entirely necessary, but we need to look at it a little more carefully to make sure that we aren't reducing protection there, because as most of you know, wetlands are important assets to the state of Minnesota. Our constitution was amended a few years ago to require us to put wetlands back. So we want to make sure we're not losing them if we're going to be putting them back under that provision. And the remainder of this, you know, is pretty much left as is. The last item on 2.31 to 2.32 does say, though, that if a local ordinance or similar local control is more restrictive, that local standard would apply. So a local government, a county, a city who's doing the shoreland zoning would be able to reduce this provision through their ordinance if they chose to. So, Mr. Chairman, members, I will stop there with the walkthrough.
Thanks, Mr. Jansky. And members, we're all handed out a map showing the different areas of Minnesota. Questions now from members. First up, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a good thing we took out the naming precedent in yesterday's bill, because we'd have to rename this one the freedom to drain it all. You know, we spent members, let me ask Mr. Jashke a question. When the Wetland Conservation Act was revised, was there a stakeholder task force that met for years?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hansen, yes, the last significant amendment to this part of the legislation was done in 2007, I believe, and yes, there was about a year and a half or 2 year process that was inclusive of a lot of stakeholder feedback and input to that legislation.
Representative?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jashke, so those were open meetings, they had public meetings, everybody was given an opportunity to provide input, is that correct?
Mr. Members of Hansen, yes, you know, the Governor Plenty had ordered the agency or directed the agency to go out and do this, you know, stakeholder process, and that was part of a number of public meetings that were held to get input, yes.
Representative.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Jashke, the prescriptive nature in the de minimis portion, did the stakeholders want that because having ambiguity led to conflict?
Mr. Members of Hansen, I don't know if I can remember it or characterize it that way. I'm remembering that this provision was, like, you know, one of the more specific things that was negotiated. I can't remember exactly how we got to that point, but there was a lot of stakeholder input, and there was a concern about wetland protection being adhered to, especially in the shoreland areas. I remember that part of it.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it was because when you leave it up to the local discretion there without the prescriptive nature, then you have fighting over it at each different local unit of government. So reluctantly, you had it put into very specific prescriptive nature so that everybody knew what the rules were. And I think it was science-based because transitional wetlands or ephemeral wetlands or what some people may call nuisance wetlands are important for a variety of biological and hydrological functions. And so allowing those to be plowed or paved can have a consequence. Mr. Jashke, when this bill, when the de minimis portion was going through the legislature in, I believe, 2007, was it a, was there quite a bit of input in public meetings that occurred there?
Mr. Chairman, Members of Panson, yes, there were several legislative hearings, and as I mentioned before, there were a number of informational or, you know, fact-gathering sessions that we sponsored in advance of that.
Representative Hansen.
And so, Mr. Chair, I look at this bill. It was introduced Monday. Monday, folks. And then here we have another a major amendment today. And this bill, and as it's amended, will have significant challenges to wetland protection. And as Mr. Jashke said, we're now paying for wetland restoration. And what this bill will do will encourage draining of wetlands, which we may be actually in the position of having to go back and restore later with public money. Bad bill. Bad bill. I don't know, Mr. Jashke, if you can make it better. It's going backwards.
Comment, Mr. Jashke?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, you know, your points about the past process I think are valid. I'm not sure, you know, if it can be made better, but I think at least we haven't had any time either. As you described, the bill came out very quickly, and our staff were off on Monday that have worked on this, just on this program in the field, and I'd like to have a chance to consult with them about what their findings and input might be. So if we have that opportunity, I'll take advantage of it.
Next question, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative McElpatrick, you described this as a bill for the benefit of small farmers. But as I look at it, it seems to me that there are other beneficiaries that are would be more than or greater beneficiaries than small farmers. Who do you think they would be?
I think my focus has been on the people in my district. As I said, this situation was brought to my attention and last year as a problem that one of the small farmers in Aiken County had, perhaps because of the difficulty with some of the understanding of the language. And he had worked with the local officials and had taken care of the problem. However, I felt that for the benefit of our small farmers, we should look at this just because it does mean that in some cases a small piece of work that's essential to their farming operation is prohibited. And I feel that we need to protect our farmers as well as our wetlands.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, from what I hear from what you're telling us, there was one small farmer, and his problem was solved working locally. And given that, compared to the massive change that's going on this bill, where the consensus, we came to an agreement several years ago with lots of input to make a major change with speculation that would help small farmers when we have one example where that small farmer has already been helped. It seems to be a great overreach to me. Could I be, I mean, doesn't it seem to be a bit of an overreach? Well, you don't have to answer that, but that's what it seems to me.
No, I'd be happy to respond to that.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was as a result of one instance that the larger conversations took place. I didn't come to this simply because there was one situation. It was because I had further conversations and found that the way the regulations are written are really impacting a number of people. And as I said in my introductory comments, we're not seeing intensive farming in the counties with a lot of wetlands the way we do, say, in southern Minnesota. So even though you may have interpreted this as a problem with one farmer in one county, it simply alerted me to a situation that impacts a number of people. And so that was what moved me to pursue this, and I'm not sure that I would characterize it, as you said, as massive changes.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really have more of a comment than a question, but you know, when a compromise creates a system that's so complicated that no one can understand it, you encourage people to avoid the system and just go ahead and do what they want to do and try and get permission later or forgiveness later. That's sort of what happened in Representative's example. This is ridiculously complicated. And if I tried to understand it, and it's just about impossible. We have so many classifications and so many different descriptions in here that a layman certainly cannot begin to grasp it. To move towards an understandable regulation, to me, is certainly appropriate. No one here is trying to destroy wetlands, but when we have restrictions that cover a 20-square-foot chunk of land, it's hard for me to imagine that that is essential to our system of wetlands here in the state of Minnesota. I don't know if someone on the other side would care to comment.
Next up, Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Representative McElfatrick, if you'd help me understand the situation, what type of wetland was affected, how many square feet that your constituent brought forward, I'm just trying to understand the issue a little bit more. I come from a farming background, so I'm somewhat familiar with this, but just what was the issue?
Representative McElfatrick.
I think it was a situation of needing to create access to a field that you know he needed to get his equipment to, and I think it was just a matter of questioning the square footage there that was touched. So as far as the specifics on the numbers, I would need to talk to the local officials. Just knowing that the work that was done that was out of compliance was restored. So that situation has been taken care of.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the person didn't have an access prior. They hadn't been able to get their equipment onto that field. They had to create a new access for some reason.
That was my understanding. I've not actually been to the site. So it would be easier for me to answer had I been to the site, but I've not.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know what type of wetland? I mean, we've got multiple classifications, as Representative Torkelson alluded to, but do you know how much had to be mitigated, or if there were certain types of flora, fauna that had to be protected?
What I know was that it was a minor restoration to bring it into compliance. This was a problem for this man, and it was not a huge out of compliance with the regulations. It was restored fairly easily, but it was an extra job that had to be done again in order to bring it into compliance, but it made it more difficult for him to do the work that he needed to do on his own property. And so, kind of to address some of the other comments that have been made here, when this situation was brought to my attention, then I began having conversations and found out that these kinds of difficulties are out there, not maybe in great abundance, but we're tying the hands of our small farmers. And I don't think that that is the objective of the state of Minnesota. in the process of needing to protect our wetlands, which is terribly important, and we all acknowledge that. And I think that most of us would agree that our farmers are good stewards of the land, and they really do care. And so to make life more difficult for them when this is their livelihood should not be our part of our process.
Representative Fall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I understand, I mean, the whole livelihood aspect, but, I mean, are we talking about 200 square feet, 500 square feet, 1,000 square feet? I mean, I don't think that it's going to be that little piece of property is going to make or break your operation. If that's the case, you probably have much bigger problems you're dealing with. But it just seems that there's very, very large changes being made here, and I still haven't really understood exactly what type of wetland, what classification of wetland, or how large this person's this issue was. And so, Representative McElpatrick, I'm trying to understand here. I mean, if it was an access point, I know equipment's gotten larger, but I mean, you can get most equipment onto a field with not that large of an access. So I'm just really kind of puzzled about what the issue is here. I mean, it hasn't been explained to me, so I want you to help me understand it better, because I haven't got a whole lot yet.
Representative?
Mr. Chairman, and I think that maybe makes the point for the bill, in that it may seem to be a small adjustment on his property, but that small adjustment took him out of compliance, and it had to be restored again. So what you're saying makes the case for the bill.
Representative Fall.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative McFedrick, I respectfully disagree. I'm just asking for you to explain it to me. I just want to know what changes had to be made, what took him out of compliance. You haven't told me yet what it was. And so how could I go and say or how could you make the point that makes the point for this bill? Because I haven't even understood exactly what it is that you're trying to do or what problem you're trying to solve. And, I mean, I understand, too, that maybe your farmer gentleman, he probably should have went and spoke with his local officials first, too. If you're going to go and make adjustments, that's kind of the onus of the operator of the land to go and talk to the person, whether it's your local soil and water conservation district or your FSA officer, and just to make sure that you're doing things to the letter of the law. That's really not that uncommon.
Further comment, Representative McElpatrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I can speak with the local officials, and I can get the square footage, and I can get the maps. I can get all of that information. But I think for the larger picture, perhaps it's enough to know, and not disputing what you're saying, but for the larger picture, I think it's enough to know that a minor adaptation that he made on his property created a problem for him. And I think that the goal of this bill is to make the regulations, as I said, more understandable and to allow protections for those people that are running what we should value, and that's small family farms. I think that's what Minnesota has been about, and I think we need to protect them. And I think that with this bill, we can do both.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I have more of a comment than any particular question, but it strikes me that we just dealt with or heard about House File 1596, Representative Torkelson's bill on a comprehensive watershed management approach, and here, I mean, we aren't given some things a chance to really work, it seems to me, and now we've got a very prescriptive, as I read it, bill in front of us regarding wetlands. And I mean, the wetlands and watersheds are, I mean, this is, you know, they exist in the same boundaries here, and it seems to me if we're going to manage comprehensively that we should have that comprehensive management plan that includes these kinds of decisions. And if it is indeed too complex, and as an old town road supervisor, you're darn right, there's some things that are difficult about wetlands and the way we do it in this day and age. But I think we have to tread very carefully about how we proceed. And I guess I'm suggesting let's look at the at 1596 in this comprehensive watershed approach, and what can we do with wetlands and preserving wetlands where we need to, and giving opportunity for those in agriculture to not have to ask forgiveness instead of permission. That's the common way it's done. And we shouldn't be put in that situation. We should not put our citizens in that situation. I guess I'm just suggesting, I think that the bill may be a little premature if indeed we give 1596, I'll file 1596, an opportunity to bring a comprehensive watershed management approach, because wetlands are water quality. There's no two ways about that. I think everybody recognizes that. They have a significant role in a watershed. So that's my comment.
Thanks, Representative. I don't think I heard a question there, so we'll move on to Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, also having a farm background, I realize that agriculture is evolving, so that I'm finding some of the neighborhood farmers where I grew up, you know, they're trying different crops, they're trying different approaches. Sometimes this requires a great deal of transition in equipment. And I'm also aware that over the years, what was wetland changes. It varies a little bit. So I've seen, you know, when I was younger, where we had access ways, you know, sort of disappear. And, you know, I think that we want to coexist, and I'm not aware of any farmer that doesn't have a deep love for the land and a long-range feeling for what needs to, you know, preserve that land. Because if they're the ones that are going to live and work there, that's their livelihood, and it's been for generations in many cases. I think I see the intent of this bill as realizing that there are small adjustments that are being made or need to be made to stay viable for especially small family farms, and that the complexity. You know, when I was a child, the complexity required to do documentation for farming was pretty straight, you know, it was easy. Now, I know a lot of farmers that have, bachelor's or master's degrees in different fields, and, you know, you're demanding all this complexity, and I don't think that you've brought in the common sense approaches that farmers tend to use. And I see this bill as trying to bring a little of that common sense back into a complex issue. I think we're all on the same side of, you know, wanting to have good water. And I invite the author to bring some more details of what brought this about, but it's not that specific instance. It's systematically we are making it difficult for someone that lives on that land, cares about that land, to do appropriate measures in a timely fashion, because we all know growing seasons and harvest seasons can be short with the weather. And I just hope that we, in the future, work on this bill, can come together and calmly work on it outside of committee. Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you for those remarks, Representative Quam, and I would just back that up. I hesitate to put words in the mouth of the author, but I've been working with her on this bill. We do understand and appreciate the agency has some discomfort with the proposed changes, and we understand and appreciate that the minority has some discomfort. Invite all of you to take part in further discussions on really looking at a system that, as I said earlier, is so complicated that people can't even explain it to each other. That really does not help us protect wetlands. I know that there was some thorough and rather contentious meetings that put this compromise together, but the result of that sort of process is not always the best product. I think we can improve on this, and I invite all those interested in this to please step forward and have some input.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jaschke, are you familiar with the site that Representative McElfatrick is discussing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, I'm not. I got an email about 5:30 yesterday from Steve Hughes, who's the Aiken County employee who's been working on this, but I tried to call him back, but he was already gone when I got the email at 5:30, or I read it at 5:30. He sent it about 4:30, I think, so I did not talk with him about this specific site.
Representative.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jaschke, so you don't know if this site has anything to do with a mitigation site for any other wetland loss? Is there any, is this a replacement site for loss somewhere else?
Mr. Jaschke?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, I don't have any facts about this case, and I'll try and get those from Mr. Hughes as soon as I can, but I haven't been able to. I don't have them with me, and I don't have them in my head either.
Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair, I'd be very interested if this site or similar sites are involving mitigation plans for losses that were occurred for other uses. If mm-hmm. that's the case, I'd like to know that.
Next question, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I see that Representative Klom left. I was just going to make a comment that I appreciated his acknowledgement of global climate change with the changing of the more radical changes in our growing seasons for farming operations. I just wanted to thank him for that and tell him how much I appreciated it.
I'm sure he will appreciate that. With that, any closing comments, Representative McElfatrick?
No, just I appreciate the discussion here, and I would welcome the participation as well from those who are concerned. And I also appreciate the work that John Jaschke has done.
I have one final question, Representative Wagenius.
This is not a question about the bill. It's after you lay it over. I would like
okay.
to.
If there's no further questions, I will move that this bill, House File 2393, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I note that that's at the end of our agenda, and I just wanted to tell the committee on the way into work this morning, I heard a report on NPR about a report from the USGS had determined why White Bear Lake is down and not refilling. And it is one of our premier metropolitan lakes, and I think it would be helpful for us in this committee to understand the science of, or engineering, I imagine it's some kind of combination there, of what happened and why they think the problem was created, because unfortunately I think we were not as good as we should have been in preventing the problem. So if it might be a good learning experience for us to hear from the USGS.
Thanks, Representative. We'll make note of that. Let the Representative McNamara know that their concern. With that, one final piece of housekeeping, would Representative Purcell approve the minutes from February 21st? Thank you very much. So approved. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. With that, this morning's meeting is adjourned.